Talkback Gardening with John Lamb and Deb Tribe
on ABC Radio Adelaide.
Welcome to Talkback Gardening, the last Talkback Gardening for the season of summer. Welcome, John Lamb.
Yes, good morning, Deb. Good morning, listeners. 2 days and it will be March, and the media are saying it's the mad March season. But vegetable growers know that March is a very, very good time for planting vegetables and looking after the fruit trees. And that's what we're going to focus on this morning. Very shortly, we'll talk to Stephen Hoffner about the vegetables that you should be putting in the ground early in autumn rather than waiting until later. Very significant difference. Stephen will also talk a little bit about fruit trees. Don't turn your back on your fruit trees simply because you've harvested the fruit. Later on in the program, we're talking
about mislabeling. You did a big survey last year, and of course, lots of mislabeling, and you had a very good input to the nursery industry. So the question is, has anything changed in 2021?
Labelling or mislabelling still a problem? And there's a survey in the Good Gardening newsletter. We'll talk how you can, or explain how you can be part of that survey very shortly.
Stay tuned for that. Plus, I have two February ABC Gardening Australia magazines to give away a little bit later this hour as well. But we are taking your calls. And while Stephen's here with us, if you've got a question about winter veggies or fruit trees for that matter, he's happy to piggyback with John to answer your questions. So call in with your questions on 1300 222 891, and if you'd like to send a comment through on the text line, they're always welcome on 0467 922 891.
The ground at the moment is deliciously warm, and if you plant anything in the ground at the moment, it will grow and grow well, providing you provide a little bit of water. We're going to focus on vegetables in particular to start with and talk with Stephen Hoffner, who's from Wagtail Urban Farm, which is a vegetable farm in the middle of the city, isn't it, Stephen? Good morning, and tell us, whereabouts are you?
Good morning. Yeah, so we're in Mitchell Park, which is near Marion. It's on the old Sturt River floodplain, so we started off with deliciously rich soil, which is deliciously warm. I love that. And yeah, we've been going for about 7 years, so you can imagine building soil over that period of time. It's just you can put anything into the soil there, and it grows really well.
It's a commercial vegetable garden.
It is. So I'm involved with a few different community gardens, but whereas community gardens are not as focused on productivity, we are.
So let's take a look at productivity. We're going to talk about why it's important to put vegetables in early in autumn rather than waiting until the season breaks, which may not be until end of April or even May. Why now?
Yeah, well, you know, you want the plants to get a jump, you know, so they plants in essence are little chemical factories, and they need, you know, it's like when we use a Bunsen burner in high school to make chemical reactions. Plants need the warmth to produce, you know, all the things that we get from them. And so if you get them in the ground now, they get established while the soil is warm, and then they've got that power to get through winter. But the later you leave it, the harder it is for them to survive or thrive in those cooler months.
Well, the soil at the moment is around about 22 degrees here in Adelaide. And if we take a look at the stats, the soil temperatures drop by 4 degrees each month. So by the end of this month, they'll be 4 degrees cooler. And by April, they'll be 12 degrees cooler than they are now. So there's a good reason in terms of temperature. Could you take a look at the difference in terms of the yield? If you plant now, say a broccoli now, or a cabbage now, versus one that was planted when the temperature is 10 or 12 degrees cooler than now.
Yeah, so take broccoli, for example. You put it in the ground now, say it's a 50 centimetre high seedling, and over the next few months it just puts out leaves, bigger and bigger leaves, and they're just collecting sunlight, you know, and storing all that energy. When it starts to form its florets, its head, it's got all these solar panels, as it were, to produce that head. Whereas if you put them in the ground, in April, they'll get fewer leaves, they'll be smaller, and they just won't have that that, you know, it just won't thrive. So you'll get a much smaller head development, and it'll just sit there through the winter months not doing anything.
Would it be an exaggeration to say you could double your yields?
I'd say triple.
Triple your yields, yeah, by planting early rather than late.
Absolutely.
Good reasons, particularly if you've only got a small garden. You're getting a lot of production from a small area by planting early.
Yeah. And, you know, planting in succession as well. So putting in a few now, a few next week, a few the week after, you know, so that you get that prolonged harvest. Because when winter hits, nothing grows. You know, we all know how cold it gets. And so the plants just sit there. They don't really put on any growth. Another thing people forget, especially with brassicas, cabbages, you know, they combat the winter chill by producing sugars. So you get your sweetest, you know, even kale. People that haven't picked kale after a frost don't know what kale really tastes like. But same with broccoli. They've just got that sweetness. So if you get a nice big formed floret, and then you pick it when it's a bit cooler, you get this beautiful, you know, the kids will love it.
I'm of the field that says kale. Why would you plant kale anyway?
I'm the same with Brussels sprouts, which most people always try and convince me they can make. You know. But we've all got our things.
Absolutely, yes. It's almost too late to plant Brussels sprouts, isn't it? People often put them in too late and wonder why they get lots of leaves and no sprouts.
Yeah, which was, you know, when I first started out, that's what I did every time. But I didn't like them anyway, so I wasn't really upset.
So there are good reasons for planting early, and we need to take a look at what are the best bets if you wanted to get the best value from a relatively small little raised garden bed in, say, a relatively small garden.
Absolutely. I mean, for me, bang for buck, it has to be greens. So like lettuce, all the Asian greens. I was actually walking through at Wagtail on Thursday and I noticed tatsoi coming up. Just, you know, I must have let one go to seed. And
tatsoi. Now, what's tatsoi for
those? It's an Asian vegetable, really beautiful in salads because it's got small, fine leaves, really rich in flavour. But it's also good for stir fries or... that's actually all I use it for. But I mainly eat it raw, just in a salad. You just cut, you know, pick the whole plant, cut all the leaves off, and it just falls apart, and it's very easy.
You could go to a garden centre, and you can see their little, what they're called, Asian greens, and people look at them and say, oh, I wonder what they are. Could you just run through two or three of the Asian greens, which are really good value?
Yeah, absolutely. So pak choi is another good one. That's a really good one for
describe a pak choi.
Pak choi, yeah, how do you describe?
Like a little mini silver beet.
Yeah. If you imagine a silver beet with a very short leaf and a very wide stem, and you harvest the whole plant, they're delicious. I used to always cook them, and then I was selling one at a market once, and this lady picked it up and just ate it like an apple. And I thought, oh, can you eat that raw? And she goes, of course, I never cook these. And then ever since then, I haven't ever really cooked them. They're
interesting.
Delicious.
Yeah. And a lot of the Asian vegetables that are like that, they're a bit like a non-hearting lettuce, aren't they? You can start pulling off the leaves on the outside. And
of course, exactly.
The more you do that, the more leaves more you get and you keep on harvesting.
Yeah, it's funny, you know, that growth hormone release when they're... because plants have that natural... If they're being attacked by something, they want to regenerate. So, yeah, cut and come again is great with the Asian vegetables.
So, we're talking with Stephen Hoffner from Wagtail Urban Farm, and he's talking about his little vegetable patch, which is quite a very productive vegetable patch, and trying to encourage you also to grow veggies, particularly get them into the ground early in autumn. There are questions coming in, Deb.
There are indeed, and we invite them. So if you would like to call through now, particularly if you have a fruit tree or a winter vegetable question, but we've just heard about a few of the veggies that Stephen's spoken about, call through now, 1300 222 891. Chris from Athelstan has done just that. Good morning, Chris.
Yeah, hi, I'm just thinking just regarding my lemon tree. I've had it for, well, we moved into the house about 7 years ago, and it was... fantastic tree, very juicy, very sour, very yellow, the colour of the skin. Now, over the last few years, it's been slowly turning orange to the fact now that it's completely orange, the skin, but it's still incredibly sour, like a lemon, and still very juicy and produces a lot of fruit. So, wondering what the issue is.
Did it when the fruit forms, they form green. Do they turn yellow and then orange, or do they just go straight from green to orange?
No, yeah, green to orange. So, there's no yellow at all.
You get some odd questions now. Here, Stephen. you're the person who's got to answer.
Of course,
it. No, you don't really.
I have seen it before. I've seen orange lemons, and I just assumed they were always quite aged, you know, because they weren't picked early enough. Right. The other thing I can think is perhaps the tree wasn't getting much sunlight prior, and in the meantime, it started to get a lot more sunlight, and so it's a response of the tree trying to protect its fruit. Would that ring true with you?
No, because it's quite an established house, and there's been no shift in terms of like putting other trees in that might have blocked sunlight, or we haven't removed anything to allow more sunlight in. So it's been in a fixed location.
You haven't got a deciduous tree. Haven't got a deciduous tree close to it, and sort of you're getting the shading from the tree, and then it drops its leaves, and you're getting sunshine on it.
The tree next to it is a mandarin tree. There's probably about a metre and a half or 2 metre gap. Probably about a 2 metre gap between the mandarin and the lemon tree. And then on the other side of the tree is my garden shed. So.
I just want to ask John, when's the next time you have Ian Tolley on the show?
Would you believe I'm actually making a little note and putting an asterisk against it?
Ask
and
Ian.
That's right, yeah. I think that we can have a bit of fun trying to answer your question there, I think.
Yeah. I think if it still tastes like lemons, then, you know, that's great.
It is what it is. That's
confuse your guests, Chris, when you make them a G&T on a Sunday evening.
So if I can find Ian home during the week, stay tuned next week. If we've got a sensible answer, I'll bring it back.
Orange.
But then we'll both know the answer to that one, Steve.
Sorry about that.
Thanks for the call, Chris. Don at Lobethal, you've got an Alberta peach. I love those peaches. Mm-hmm. Welcome.
Yes, they are beautiful peaches, but I don't get many.
Uh-huh.
The question is, you talk about summer pruning. I've never done it. The tree is about 10 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I've just done winter pruning.
Mm-hmm.
Summer pruning sounds to be what you should be doing. Now, when I pruned it last year down fairly short, trying to keep it down to about 2.5 metres max, and when it's shot out, it's grown up about 2 metres stems, quite a lot of them. And now, how do I cut them back to make fruit next year?
So in a nutshell, with this deciduous fruit tree, if you prune it in the wintertime, it grows vigorously in the spring to reclaim that space that it's lost. It's great when you've got a small tree to get it up to the height that you want it, but once you get it to the height you want it, that's when you swap over to summer pruning. Summer pruning, in a nutshell, if you go up to the tree and find the very tip of its growth, the growth that it's put out this previous season, and follow that back, you'll see that there's a distinct change in colour on the bark where it becomes the previous year's growth. So all you want to do is the growth that happened this year, cut that in half, and do that for all of those bits of growth that you can reach. It's quite tedious with secateurs, but you get into a rhythm. And then everything that you can't reach, leave. Now, when winter rolls through, all of those branches that you couldn't, all those ones that you couldn't reach, cut those branches back. And so you sort of use that to open up the center of the tree. It might take a couple of years to do it all, because you don't want to do more than one or two or three at the max big cuts into a tree once you've got that summer pruning done, because otherwise then you get the explosive growth again in the winter, in the spring.
When during summer should you carry out that summer pruning?
The best time is just after you've harvested. Now, you would have picked them sort of, you know, beginning of this month, wouldn't you, or last month, wouldn't you?
Oh, yes, honey, you got about 5 pieces, that's it. about a fortnight, 3 weeks ago, I picked them, and I'm thinking that this is summer and almost autumn, so it should be done.
Well, Lobethal is a bit different as well, because you've got a much shorter growing season. But yeah, preferably straight after harvest, but any time before it goes dormant is okay.
But Don, you heard it from Stephen. Summer pruning, summer pruning, summer pruning. Stop winter pruning if you want fruit and summer prune. It's a comment I've been talking about for about 20 years and it seems like nobody's listening.
It's finally getting traction. It is finally getting traction.
There you go, Don. Ken at Valair, you've got a Eureka lemon?
Yes, good morning. I have a Eureka lemon, and it is constantly in bud and flower and fruit, sort of everything happening constantly all the time, which leaves me wondering when I should prune it.
Oh, excellent. And the reason you want to prune it is because it's getting too big and unruly, is that
well,
right?
Well, yes, it's growing a lot, yes.
Okay, so Sir Ian Tolley, I think he's a sir now, he's been knighted, hasn't he? He says that with the lemon tree especially, you divide it up into 12 segments, and then you just prune one segment every month. And that way you keep that flowering and fruiting happening, but you keep the size of the tree down.
Right. Okay. I'll try that. Thank you very much.
Thanks for calling through, Ken.
Okay. Thank you. Bye.
Our very special guest this morning is Stephen Hoffner. He is talking winter veggies and fruit trees. If you've got a question, he and John Lamb would love to hear from you. The number is 1-300-222-891. We'll come back with more after this.
Talkback Gardening with John Lamb and Deb Tribe
on ABC Radio Adelaide.
Special guest in the studio this morning is Stephen Hoffner, urban farmer from Wagtail Urban Farm in Mitchell Park. Now, we've had a text question for you from Pat. The text line is 0467922891 saying, what is the ideal time to plant garlic? Harry's garden, it says here, in his garden.
Classic question. And, you know, the answer is you have to check your garlic. There's lots of old stories about when to plant, but the best way is if you get a clove of garlic. I actually brought some into the studio.
Yes, and I can smell it.
Yum.
I say, what did Git Deb have for breakfast?
Exactly.
Something healthy. And if you slice the garlic top to bottom, so from the toe to the tip, you'll see that inside the garlic there's a shoot. And when that shoot is about a centimetre from breaking through to the top, that's the ideal time to plant garlic.
So the garlic will actually tell you it's time to plant.
Because early varieties, of course, have to be planted earlier and later varieties have to be planted later. So the best way is just open up a clove of garlic, have a look, and then, you know, make some delicious
So you've got that. Your clump, you pull your clump to pieces and you've got your little cloves.
Cloves, yep.
And so you take the outer skin off.
You don't have to for checking it.
No,
I'll do it again. I've got the knife here.
You've got a knife. You can't really see what
slicing through the clove.
I'm jealous. You've got a lovely knife too.
Now see that one there, John. Can you see that shoot in the middle?
It's in the middle, there's a very distinct. You can see that's a shoot, and it's dormant. Or if you do it normally, it's not dormant. And when that starts to move, you're suggesting.
Yep.
It's time to plant.
They're sensitive. I guess they're sensitive to daylight hours, or maybe it's the temperature.
And so it will differ according to the variety.
Absolutely.
So when you buy an early maturing or early germinating garlic or a late one.
Absolutely.
Yes.
So check your advice on the label if you possibly can.
Yeah.
Or
the label is within the garlic clove itself.
Right.
Yeah. If you want information on garlic, particularly the different varieties of garlic and the best varieties for South Australia, Penny Woodward has written a wonderful book on just called Garlic. So if you Google or type in Penny Woodward garlic, I'm sure that you'll come up with a wonderful amount of information. So best variety for South Australia. Have you got one?
Look, I don't know what this variety is called.
Oh, that's okay.
This one was from Harry Harrison, and I didn't ever get the name of it, but it grows really well. Yes. So I think it's Australian Pink or something. But
very shortly, you'll find garden centres will have little plastic trays of garlic. There is a wonderful grower of garlic cloves for sale to us as gardeners, and they are in. You get about 20 in a little tray, and if you take a look at the different varieties there, and they should have early or mid or late season. But I can't think of the name of the gentleman who
Wade Newman.
We might try and get him back on the program. We talked to Penny Woodward last year about garlic, but maybe it's Wade's turn.
Well, it's never too much garlic for me.
It's such a lovely crop.
It is indeed. And just on the text line, Dave from Mount Pleasant says, kale, beautiful. Got little plants coming up now. Keep my own seeds, scatter them in my beds. All come up, makes great soup.
So, have you got a favourite kale?
I actually grow sea kale, which is a rare variety, but it's perennial, so it just stays in the ground, and it grows really strongly through summer. It actually goes dormant through winter.
What do you do to make it edible?
You pick the leaves when they're young. My partner, she juices it, actually. So she
makes a smoothie.
Well, just the juice, you know. We do actually use it in smoothies too.
I'll have bananas any day in my smoothie.
Let's move from kale to fruit.
Please do. And I should say, if you've got a question, please call in now, 1-300-222-891.
Could we take a look at why you shouldn't abandon your fruit tree once you've harvested the fruit?
Yeah, absolutely. If you put yourself into the plant's, you know, the fruit tree's shoes or roots, as it were, it's just done all this, you know, sun collecting and converting into sugars and storing them in the fruit, and then it's a lot of work, and you actually see that the tree it stops growing while the fruit is really ripening up, and then when you harvest the fruit, it sort of goes and then starts growing again. Now, if it doesn't have the resources that it needs, i.e. adequate water, adequate nutrition, you know, especially with something like citrus, the roots are up against the soil surface, and if they dry out, it stresses. So there's not a mulch layer around it. Then the plant sort of, it stresses quite badly, and that affects the following season. Now, I can't remember if it's 6 years or 4 years, but each bud in a, especially in like stone fruit, each dormant bud has the potential information for the next 4 to 6 years of its growing. So if it has a lovely environment and lots of food, it thinks this is great, and it produces more fruit buds for the following year and the year after that and the year after that. But if we don't give them that adequate water, if we don't give them that adequate food, then they think, oh, it might be lean and I better reduce the amount of, you know, fruit that I have to produce, because that'll stress me.
So when you said a moment ago the tree is still growing, it's not actually putting on lateral growth, it's actually growing within the bud, and it's what's going on, like a little computer working out and
saying,
am I going to produce 6 buds, or am I going to put bunches of fruit here, or am I not going to do anything at all?
Absolutely. I mean, it is putting on lateral growth as well, and because we've had such a mild summer, I've noticed almost all the stone fruit has new lateral growth, and that's been going on for weeks now. But yeah, it's also storing that information.
All right, so it's a critical time to do what?
Well, definitely fertilize. You know, it doesn't have to be a strong fertilizer. You want to make sure you've got a decent amount of potassium in the fertilizer, not so much nitrogen, and adequate watering. You know, we tend to be stingy with water in Adelaide. Although I was listening on the way into the studio, and there was a couple of people that rang in that were overwatering, but generally we tend to underwater, and we can get away with it, but there's critical times that trees, especially fruit trees, need water. So just after harvest, when they're, you know, going back into a growth flush, and also just leading up to harvest. So at fruit set, really good time to give a lot of water. And then as the fruit is colouring up, is also a good time to give a lot of water.
Let's come back to fertilising. Many people are now moving away from the granular fertilisers to organic fertilisers, and they scatter the little pellets on the ground. Mm-hmm. Could you explain why it's important not to just leave them on the surface of the ground?
Yeah, this is such a common thing. You know, I go into people's gardens and I see just these little, look like rabbit food sprinkled on the soil surface. But that isn't accessible to the plants. Now, any fertilizer will have a nitrogen component, but we forget that nitrogen is a very volatile gas. It off-gases very quickly. That's why there's so much in the air that we breathe. So what you have to do is when you sprinkle your fertilizer around the drip zone of the trees, you then have to maybe get your garden fork, even a rake if you can, and loosen up that soil. And then what I do is I put a layer of compost over the top and then tilt it in using a hoe. So you want to get that fertilizer into the top 10 centimeters of the soil. That's where the plant's roots can access it, and it doesn't off-gas all that nutrients.
Okay. Getting some information on the text line, 0467922891. Di from the Eyre Peninsula says, thank you so much for that information on garlic. I got a clove out and cut it straight away, and mine is still dormant. I've wanted to know this, so thank you. Thanks, Stephen, for that. Mary at Cuddly Creek says, my garlic left in the ground from last year started coming up with the last rain, which sounds very lucky indeed. And Eve from Goolwa is on the line. Oh, where's she gone? Nope, she's disappeared. But someone was asking, are you talking about planting seedlings or seeds right now?
I'd be doing both. I tend not to put seeds straight into the ground anymore because earwigs and slugs and all those sorts of things just love getting onto them. So I've got a raised bench where I do all my seed raising. But if you want to get a jump on the season, if you go down to a garden centre or, you know, even the Adelaide Farmers Market has, a brilliant seedling lady there, you can get your winter veggies that are already... about 50 centimetres high, a little bit bigger, pop them in the ground and they'll get established very quickly. Obviously, keep the water up to them and until we start getting rains.
I'll just check. Does that answer your question, Eve? Sorry, we lost you on the line there.
Yeah, sorry, it dropped out. I think it does. Thank you very much indeed.
Oh, well, thanks for calling in, Eve. It's good to know whether that's what you're talking about.
On that point of growing them from seed, how long does it take once you plant the seed to it gets up to the seedling stage where you're going equivalent to what you're buying in the garden centre? In other words, if we put it another way, if you buy a seedling from a garden centre, how many weeks of growth are you actually ahead?
Yeah, I mean, it all depends on how warm that seedling is as it's growing. So in the warmer months, it would probably take, 4 to 6 weeks. But as it gets cooler, that becomes a lot longer, probably yes. 6 to 8 weeks.
And so often people will plant their seeds, they come out of the ground and plump, they go over because of the damping off disease. And have you got any secrets in terms of preventing damping off?
I heard what you said on the way in, and that's a really good way. We dip the seed raising tray into like a shallow bath and they water from the roots up. I actually have an irrigation system in a greenhouse and it finely mists. And so the fine mist doesn't make the soil particles jump up onto the plant and also resist stamping off.
And also potting mixes, I think sometimes they can be, they've got a fair amount of composting material or perhaps a cocoa peat in them, and they probably hold onto the water, and just adding some perlite, I find, I don't know whether you're a perlite user, but just increasing the aeration of
Absolutely.
The potting mix
yeah,
itself.
Yeah, I mean, I make my own up and it's... I think it's one part compost to one part sand and one part koi fiber. Don't quote me on that, that seems to work as well. And then a fine fertilizer.
In about 3 weeks' time, we'll actually be talking about propagation in detail when we talk to
Matt Coulter
from the Botanic Gardens.
Mr. Propagation, as we call him.
Proper propagation.
Can we take one last call before
sure.
we let Stephen go this morning? That's Elizabeth at McLaren Vale. Elizabeth, you've got a peacherine question.
Yes, I have a small peacherine. It's about 2 metres tall. But we do have a very large ornamental pear of a few metres away, which means it gets a fair bit of shade. But so it's not growing well on that side, even though the peacherine's on the western side of the big tree. When I'm pruning, and I'm not sure exactly when to do that, I think it's about June, isn't it?
If you prune in June, you prune too soon.
Too soon.
July.
Okay.
I tend to do all my pruning in July.
July.
Obviously
now,
on
the
a dry
thing
day.
Is, because it's kind of lopsided, should I kind of prune it so it's kind of equal all round, I suppose, is what I'm saying, because it's kind of like gappy.
Yeah. Look, I coined this phrase, flavouritism. What do you prefer, the peacherine or the pear?
Well, the pears are ornamental. There's nothing you can eat off that. And that's about, I don't know, it's about four times the height of the peacherine, three times the height or something.
Do you have an open fireplace at home?
Look, the flowers are so beautiful in spring. I don't really want to chop it, but it probably does need chopping back because it almost takes up half the yard. It's huge.
Yeah. The peacherine is just searching for light, and it doesn't matter if you cut it equally. It'll always be sort of leaning out on that sunny side, trying to get to the light. So, you could go for the bonsai classic cascade style peacherine where you just cut off the other side of the tree that's not doing well and just have it sort of leaning over in the backyard. I would say if you don't want to cut down the pear or at least severely trim it, maybe plant another peacherine.
Okay, then. Now, the other thing, which isn't a fruit tree, but very quickly, I've got a little hedge that we put in out the front, and it's a unimus or something like that.
Unimus, yes.
And it's been in 2 years, and it's now looking a bit raggy, but it's growing beautifully. When is the best time to trim it into shape?
Right now. Off with its head. trim it.
There you go. Two for the price of one, Elizabeth. And I did say we'd give one question before we let you go, Stephen, but Jenny from Clearview has rung through with a quick question on dog manure. Hi, Jenny.
Hi. Now, I know that you can't put dog manure directly on vegetables that you're going to eat because hygiene and all of that, disease transmission, but is there a way that dog manure can be used with fruit trees, and how does one go about collecting it, storing it, and then applying it? Because I know a dog breeder who's got about 5 or 6 dogs, and there is a lot of manure, and it's got a lot of goodness in it because it's very good food that's going into those dogs.
Yeah, this is a question that's been coming up a lot lately. I still would be hesitant. I mean, having any manure on the soil surface, that it can be detrimental because of all the pathogens. Mm. But there are products around that are submerged in the ground. They're like almost like a worm farm that's submerged in the ground that you can put the manure into. I still think it would be very rich. I can't give a definite answer.
I think the best solution there is, because there are health implications, so the best thing to do is put it into the green waste bin. You might have a smelly bin, but it gets carted off and it gets put into a compost heap where the temperature gets up to 70 degrees, and that will kill off any nasties, and then it is mixed up with other organic materials, and it comes back as materials that go back into landscapes and things like this. So the green waste bin, I think, is probably the best thing for dog manure.
Thanks, Jenny. And just finally, someone asked, does Wagtail Urban Farm have an Instagram page, please?
Oh, no, we don't. We hardly update our Facebook.
Okay, well, there you go. You just do it old school. Come and visit. Yeah.
But every Thursday.
I mean, you, apart from being a commercial vegetable gardener, you do actually get out and work with community gardens. You actually get out and do summer pruning to help people to learn how to summer prune.
Yeah, look, I'm only at Wagtail once a week, and that's on a Thursday. The other 4 days a week, I have an edible landscaping business, which used to be called Earthright, but now I'm transitioning to Wagtail Urban Farms because that's how everyone knows me. So you can find me, if you want to, on somewhere.
Well, Stephen Hoffner, I love the way you think, and I love the Stephenisms, like
flavoritism.
Prune in June and you prune too soon. Love that one. That's going to be part of my little...
Take it. I can't remember where I got it from.
Well done. Listen, lovely having you in the studio. Makes all the difference when you can see eye to eye. You have a very, very expressive face. And thank you for bringing the garlic.
Pleasure.
Maybe you could leave the little pieces behind.
Oh, maybe.
Thank you very much.
Suit the studio.
Goodness gracious. So, Stephen Hoffner, many thanks.
Thank you, Stephen. Lovely to have you in the studio with us this morning. We're coming back to general talkback gardening calls in just a moment. The number is 1-300-222-891.
Talkback Gardening with John Lamb and Deb Tribe
on ABC Radio Adelaide.
Thanks for this week.
John Lamb, thanking Stephen, our wonderful gardener, joining us this morning. Text from Todd has come in for you this morning, John, saying, can you pass on to John my thanks reburying a banana under a tomato plant? Tried it under one plant and it outperformed a hand-grafted plant. So there you go. Good advice. Thank you very much for letting us know that, Todd. June is at Arno Bay. June, you've got the perennial problem of earwigs.
Yes, they're absolute rotters. I don't see them, but I can see the damage on my plants, on the especially the succulents, some of the succulents that I've got. They've got all these little pop marks all over them. You don't see anything eating them, and somebody told me that they're definitely earwigs. Is that what do you think it could be?
Well, if you've got succulents, they're a little bit too tough for an earwig to get munching into. You find that earwigs will get stuck into the soft fruit strawberries they love, and if there's an injury in a piece of fruit, it'll get in there and start eating the flesh. But you don't find that they don't normally get stuck into the hard tissues. Now, the exception is when you get large populations. Have you got huge populations?
Well, this is the whole thing. You don't see them, but I picked up a mat the other day that was outside, and when I picked it up, there were just, you know, these rotten earwigs everywhere.
Yes. Well, I'd be also just concerned that if you've got they're little nicks out of the succulents, is it?
Yeah, they're like they've been little pock marks sort of scooped out, and the leaves just dry right out. You know, especially on look, I don't know what this succulent's called, but it's got quite a big leaf, and it has sort of a pinky edge to it
right.
That grows reasonably, you know, reasonably well.
The critters that really love succulents are slugs and snails. It's not the time
right.
for them. And you'll find there are one or two caterpillars that will just take a little piece out of it. And there are little weevils, little beetle-like things, weevils. And they can also take little pock marks. So I think you need to get out at night times, June, and just see if you can see who's doing the damage. Earwigs, if you've got large numbers, you need to do something. A small population is a good thing in the garden. They are pretty good. They're on our side, except that when they get out of control. And I think your best way of doing that is getting little trays, a little sort of plastic trays or saucer or something like that, and put some juice in there. People use oils of different kind, and you can flavour them with a little bit of soy sauce or something like that. But you bury them almost into the ground so that the earwigs can get into there, and then they drown, and end of story.
Right.
But you need to do that on a very regular basis. There are hundreds of them out there, and it's population dynamics. You need to actually reduce the population, and once the population is down, there'll still be a few out there, and they'll be looking after your garden.
Right, right. There's just one more thing, John. In this season, our tomatoes have just been absolutely shocking. And what's happened, they come up and they're starting to look absolutely lovely, and then they've got this big black bottom on them.
Righto, that's blossom end rot. That's a lack of calcium in the tomato. And the lack of calcium, the calcium is probably in the soil, and it's taken slowly up into the plant. But if the plants dry out in between watering, they get stressed, or sometimes if you get overwatering and you get root rots. But it's usually associated with poor watering, and you don't have an even flow of sap through the tomato plant into the fruits. And as a result of that, calcium doesn't move very rapidly in a plant, and so you get a shortage of calcium in the actual fruit itself. And as a result of that, you get breakdown in the cells at the bottom end, which is what's called bottom end rot.
Bottom end rot.
So improve the way you water and the problem should disappear.
Thank you, June. Jim in Gilberton is up next with a snake plant query. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Deb. Morning, Deb. Morning, John. Snake plant or the degrading name, mother-in-law's tongue, take your pick.
Yeah, John, sure. Sansevieria.
What do you like to call them?
Sansevieria is probably the technical.
Yeah, well,
but anyway, we all know what you're talking about, Jim, so tell us the problem.
Well, there's not a problem, but I've noticed I've had one or two in the as pot plants and not well cared for. I've never seen one bloom until now. Is that rare or not?
It is relatively rare. They don't flower on a regular basis. The plant has actually got, it takes a long time to actually build up enough energy and build up the reserves to allow it to flower. And then,
well, sorry, John.
I was going to say, so it's got to be able to build up energy. That's part of the story. But it's also got to have a trigger to actually want to make it want to move from growth mode into flowering stage. And it's usually associated with stress. And it's usually the people that neglect their plants find that, oh, isn't it interesting, my little succulents are starting to flower. And I think probably there's a story there, but the plant is thinks it's going to come to an end and so it wants to flower and procreate. But anyway, it happens, but it is not a regular, but it is does happen.
So make sure you get a photo of it, Jim.
I did, and as far as neglect is concerned, That fits the bill completely.
Thank you for the call, Jim. Good luck. William is at Glenelg. Now, you need to prune your Nandina, William.
Yes, I do. Good morning, both of you. I've got a row of Nandinas. There's three or four that are excellent, another five or six that are satisfactory, and then six that I intend taking out. But with the ones that are excellent and satisfactory, they really need a haircut. And I was wanting some guidance as far as that's concerned, please.
We're talking about dwarf Nandinas?
I'm not sure. They're
about knee high.
Yeah, well, the good ones that I've got are probably a metre high, a metre and a bit higher, but the rest are about knee high, yeah.
All right, okay. Let's assume that we're talking about the dwarf Nandina, of that species.
Okay.
And do you want them to have lovely colour in winter is the question?
No, they just need to survive, not fussed about
right.
that.
Well, if you're not worried about them, because if Nandinas, they're building up their energy, and what's got to happen if you want lovely colour on your Nandinas is to expose them to the cold weather, the cold nights which we're going to get between now and the middle of winter, and that should help them cover.
Okay.
And the worst thing you can do, if anybody has got your Nandinas and wants colour on them and concerned that they all stay green, stop feeding them now, stress them a little now, and put them out into the boondocks where they get exposed to the cold weather. That will help them to go red in the middle of winter.
Okay.
But in your situation, if you prune, you can actually do the pruning now, and that will encourage it to send out new growth. And that growth during winter will be bright green. It won't be red. And if you don't care about that, do it now.
No.
Otherwise, do it in the middle of early spring.
Okay.
Thanks for the call, William. And
thank you very much.
Thank you. Greg at Campbelltown, you've got some white on your zucchini leaves.
Yes, I'm just asking a question on behalf of my husband.
Oh, you're not Greg?
No, I'm not. Zucchini leaves, we've got white all over them.
Yep.
And last night Gardening Australia said not to put the leaves in compost unless it was a hot compost. He wants to know, what do I get rid of the white on the leaves? The zucchini fruit is good.
Right. The white will be powdery mildew. And I don't know that it makes much difference. If you've got lots of leaves, I would actually be putting them. If you've got a good compost, if you've got the compost you make, does it sort of heat up a bit? Or does it just sort of, just a heap that sort of just sits there and moulders?
No, it heats up a little bit, yeah.
Okay. If you get a compost heap and it develops heat, and you've got to get up to probably about 50 or 60 degrees, and so that's a fair amount of warmth in a heap, that'll knock off any kind of nasties. But even in a crummy old heap, you'll find that the plants will be, they'll decay and they will be converted back into compost. And I don't think it really makes that much difference. You might have a few extra powdery mildew spores in your compost, but the spores are floating around in the air. And you may not have any compost at all, and you're still going to get powdery mildew. If you've got the right kind of temperatures and humidity in particular, and a cloudy day, and it's the end of the season and the plants have stopped growing vigorously, you're going to get powdery mildew, and you need to put on a fungicide to stop it. And after it, when you've got your powdery mildew plants, how you dispose of them, put them in the green waste bin. If you want to, put them into compost, because if we get the right kind of conditions next year, you're still going to get powdery mildew. And the amount of spores that will be carried over in the compost heap, I think, is immaterial to the story.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Greg's partner, who we don't have a name for. Appreciate your call. We'll come back to more of your calls in a moment. I've got a magazine to give away. In fact, I've got two February ABC Gardening Australia magazines to give away. The number to call is 1-300-222-891.
Talk Back Gardening with John Lamb and Deb Tribe
on ABC Radio Adelaide.
Deb Tribe and John Lamb with you this morning. Congratulations to our magazine winners, Kathy from Spalding and Grant from Kilkenny, who will get those magazines sent out to them very shortly. Mislabeling, John, you did a big survey on it last year, and as we found out, quite a significant problem.
Yes, we had hundreds of people replied to the survey, and 56% of those that actually filled in the survey had a problem with labelling, in particular seedlings, and even more particular with tomatoes. So we wanted to know, is it still a problem? And so as a result of what happened last year, we've basically repeated the survey, and it's in this week's Good Gardening newsletter. And if you haven't got the Good Gardening newsletter, you can subscribe to it, and we'll repeat the survey next week. And then the information will be collated and we'll bring it back to Talk Back Gardening, and we'll talk about, is there still a problem or not? But it would appear that it certainly did cause a lot of concern, didn't it?
It certainly did. I was so surprised. And even this morning we heard someone that thought they were buying zucchini and end up with cucumbers, but it didn't matter because they were very delicious. But if you go into the survey, I think it closes on the 9th of March, so you've got just over a week in which to do it, and then we'll talk about it the following Saturday.
Yes, and so, it won't take very, very long. It's very similar. The important thing is that I looked at the survey this morning. There's over 100 people have already replied, even though it was only yesterday that the survey was published. But it's important, even if you didn't have a mislabeling problem, that you actually fill in the survey and say no, and it's probably only have to answer two questions, because otherwise it's awfully biased. Those are a little bit miffed that they've got a mislabeling problem. They filled out the survey, and so it's biased towards those that are having problems. And it's important we gather that information, because if more than half the people that are sort of filling in the survey have got a problem, well then we report that to the nursery industry. And last year they were very good in actually contacting the people that provide the plants, and we would like to think that the problem has disappeared.
That's right.
But so maybe not.
This is your chance. Your voice, John takes your voice and takes it back to the nursery industry. So if you're not on the Good Gardening newsletter, make sure that you sign up for that. It comes into your email box without you doing anything every Friday morning. It's got all sorts of information, and we do have that symbiotic relationship here with the Good Gardening newsletter and Talk Back Gardening. So,
Very early, just a quick look at it indicates it's still a problem.
Well, there you go. I think we can squeeze in at least one more caller, Juliet at Morfitt Vale on an apple tree. Hi, Juliet.
Hi. I'm just ringing. My sister gave me an apple that her friend had given her, and she thought it was kind of funny. She asked me to cut it open, and it looked like a normal red apple. And then when I cut it open, it was bright red inside and looked quite different from a normal apple. And
yes,
I thought there was something wrong with it.
Nothing.
But apparently it's a certain variety, and it kind of has a cherry taste to it, but I don't know what it's called, and I really want to get a tree now because they're delicious.
It's called Red Love Apple, the Red Love Apple. It is red skin, and when you cut it open, it's red, red, red. And it's been designed for those that like eating apple and cheese on a platter.
Oh, looks lovely.
Or if you like cooking and you want sort of your apple pie to look a little bit bit different to everybody else's. It's just a new variety which was only released last year, and it is, I think, if you're a gourmet person and like entertaining, it's the kind of apple you need to have in your own garden. Red Love it's called, and it should be available as a tree during winter. But go along to your garden centre and put in an order and say, I want a Red Love apple, please, and they'll make sure you get one.
Congratulations for bringing that to our attention, Juliet. A Red Love sounds wonderful. Now, John, am I putting you on the spot if we just ask Jane from Rosslyn Park to be very quick about her mildew on hollyhocks? Hi, Jane.
Hi, thank you. Really tall hollyhock flowers every year that are splendiferous, absolutely gorgeous, but the big leaves at the bottom tend to get downy mildew. And I heard your earlier downy mildew information, but what causes that?
Well, it's just the environmental conditions. Are you sure it's downy mildew?
No, I guess I'm not.
No.
But a lot of them are self-sown now.
Yeah, they're more likely to get rust. You get little sort of, it's an orangey kind of material on the backs of the leaves. And whether it's a powdery mildew, a downy mildew, if you use Mancozeb Plus, that is very effective on a whole range of different kind of funguses. And so as soon as you can see your little seedlings coming up, before they get too big, put on a spray, and then once they are at the normal height, put on a second spray, and that should be end of the problem.
So hopefully,
thank you so much, both of you, and a great show.
Oh, thanks, Jane. Lovely to hear from you. We squeezed you in and all. Covered a lot of ground this morning, John, didn't we?
Yeah, great fun with Stephen. I really do like having people in the studio. You can see the eye contact, and he was having a ball himself.
He was, he brought us some beautiful sweet corn as well, which is very kind of him.
Sure. Now, make sure that you're listening next week, because at the end of summer, Darren Ray, independent climatologist, suggests no heat waves, heat spikes, and it's going to be very, very dry. What's he going to tell us about autumn? Mm. He'll be along with his three-month weather outlook for home gardeners in next week's program. Until then, I'll say goodbye.
And good gardening.
Oh, yeah, and good gardening.